Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's White House visit by Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS, whose arrival coincided with a rare vote in the U.S. Senate on the War Powers Act being invoked to end U.S. involvement in a devastating war in Yemen that MBS escalated in 2015 with a brutal bombing campaign and a blockade that has created the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Brian Katulis, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who focuses on national security policy in the Middle East and recently met with MBS in Saudi Arabia, joins us to discuss the public relations campaign underway to portray MBS as a reformer ahead of his expected promotion as the next king of Saudi Arabia, replacing his ailing father on the throne. We will assess the extent of the commingling of statecraft and business interests between MBS and his new friend Jared Kushner, and remarks made by MBS in a recent 60 Minutes interview in which he talked of Saudi Arabia acquiring nuclear weapons, with a likely step in that direction being an announcement by Trump that the U.S. will sell Saudi Arabia dual-use nuclear reactors. Then we'll look into the war MBS is waging against Yemen and the vote today in the Senate of 55-44, which killed a bipartisan resolution to end U.S. complicity in the bombing and starving of Yemeni women and children. Shireen Aladimi, a graduate student at Harvard University who is originally from Yemen, joins us to discuss the nature of U.S. military support for MBS's war on Yemen and the complex internecine fighting that is destroying Yemen, which is already the poorest country in the Middle East. Then finally, we'll go to the UK to speak with Mike Harris, the CEO of 89UP and the publisher of Little Adams. He writes on human rights, surveillance and free speech and joins us to discuss the angry reaction in the British Parliament to revelations that Cambridge Analytica used personal data from Facebook to influence the Brexit vote, along with helping Trump win the US election. We'll discuss a video sting by Channel 4 in the UK that exposes the head of Cambridge Analytica boasting on hidden camera about his role in defeating Hillary Clinton and his offer to supply Ukrainian girls to entrap rival politicians. And joining us now is Brian Katulis, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who focuses on U.S. national security policy in the Middle East and South Asia. He has served on projects in more than 24 countries, including Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Egypt. And from 1995 to 1998, he lived and worked in the West Bank and Gaza Strip and Egypt. And in 1994 and 1995, he was a Fulbright Scholar in Amman, Jordan, where he conducted research on the peace treaty between Israel and Jordan. An Arabic speaker. He's the co-author of The Prosperity Agenda. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Katulis.
Great to be with you.
And the visit today by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, otherwise known as MBS, to the White House, of course, coincided with a rare use of the War Powers Act in the U.S. Senate in a resolution that was voted down 55-44. Had that resolution passed, and it was a bipartisan resolution offered by Senator Mike Lee, Republican of Utah, and Bernie Sanders. That would have been a bit of an embarrassment, would it not, for the White House and for MBS. But do you think any kind of compromise deal was made in the background there somewhere, Brian? In other words, here we are voting for this unconscionable war on Yemen that is the worst humanitarian crisis on the planet. And obviously there's going to be arms deals or some announcement about further deals with Saudi Arabia. So do you think that the pressure from Madison, the Pentagon, on senators, was there any possibility of something being done about the human rights situation?
I think there's still a possibility because there's even within the Trump administration and the Pentagon, there's serious concern about how Saudi Arabia is conducting the war. And if you look at Secretary Mattis's public statements, including on visits to Saudi Arabia, he has been critical of Saudi Arabia. And President Trump late last year also criticized the humanitarian situation in Yemen. This particular attempt, I think many scholars and lawyers raised questions about whether this was an effective use of the war powers argument, because what the United States actually does is quite limited in terms of the support it gives to the Saudis. And the other thing is there are different types of missions the United States actually conducts and supports in Yemen, which aren't just against the Houthis. There are terrorist groups there. So I think there's probably a way to build a compromise that actually sends the right message to the Saudis. The wrong message is the one that Trump more or less has been sending, which is giving them a blank check. But I think if the co-sponsors of this legislation want to find a pathway for meaningful leverage against the Saudis, I think there are ways to do that without sort of raising the types of opposition we saw that got the majority of the senators to vote against this.
So there's obviously a public relations campaign underway to make MBS, the Crown Prince, appear to be a reformer. And you met with him, I believe, recently in Riyadh. What was your impressions? I mean, is he really the real deal? I mean, there's obviously a bit of a mixed message here. On the one hand, he wants women to drive, but on the other hand, he's a reformer who's prepared to spend $500 million on a Leonardo da Vinci and $500 million on a luxury yacht.
Yeah, no, this is a complicated message. And I think the one thing that I think he's sincere about is reforming how the religion of Islam is interpreted. And I see this manifested in various visits to the kingdom, and the most recent one showing that the religious police, which used to actually be quite fearful, you know, I was fearful of them, and they would harass a lot of people, they've been disempowered. I think that's the one aspect that, thank heavens, if Saudi Arabia is truly moving in this direction, and I think it's still early, after decades of supporting very radical and conservative forms of Islam, if he's sincere about that, and I think he is, I think we should applaud that. On the other fronts, I think it's very, very mixed. Saudi Arabia is an absolute monarchy. It still has a horrific human rights record at home. I think they should be applauded for allowing women to drive, finally, but this is the 21st century, so they're well behind the curve on that. And the biggest impression I get, though, is less about him as a leader, but more from the society itself, that it's a very young society. And many of the Saudis that I saw out in the streets, many of them were educated in places like Europe and the United States, and now they're back, and they simply just don't want what their parents had. And I think even though it's an absolute monarchy, the leaders have to respond to what the public wants. And I think in some ways, Saudi Arabia may be changing and moving in the right direction after what has been decades of a terribly conservative and backward-looking regime. But it's by no means sort of, it's only in the first stages of that.
So the religious police, Mutawa, of course, are another aspect of this duality that's gone on with the House of Saud, where on the one hand they have all these princes and enormous wealth and no accountability and absolute power, and there are simply no other very little vestiges or even indications of any democratic rule. So you had this kind of game being played by the House of Saud, you know, have the people give us total loyalty at the same time, we'll give you, the religious authorities, enormous leeway. And many people have argued that this has led to the radicalization of Islam and even by extension bin Laden and the Islamic State. So is there a possibility that MBS will visit Ground Zero at the World Trade Center in New York?
I don't know his actual schedule. I know he's going to different cities. I'd be surprised if he would do that, given that 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. And there's already a lot of political controversy, which I think is understandable, about this visit. Anytime an absolute monarchy comes into contact with an open democracy like ours, we should have a robust debate with multiple voices there. I think, you know, when I met with him, and he said this publicly in recent interviews as well, he seemed to indicate, well, Osama bin Laden specifically recruited those individuals to give Saudi a bad name. Again, I think that sounds a little far-fetched. and far-fetched to most American ears. So we do have this understandable doubt and skepticism about Saudi Arabia, about its past. It's linked to 9/11. It's linked to their support for extremist conservative Islam, like I talked about before. It's linked to deeper issues, too. I know my father's generation here in America remember Saudi Arabia for the OPEC oil moves back in the 1970s and the gas lines. So Saudi Arabia has a bad image, and it's based on a reality where they haven't done a lot of good things for its own people, and they have done some things that really have undermined U.S. interests. But they've also, I think, are perhaps moving in the right direction here. Again, we'll have to see. I think another mistake that they may be making right now is aligning themselves so closely to a president here, President Trump, who's so unpopular and so controversial. And our presidents come and go. And unfortunately, in Saudi Arabia, you don't have those opportunities to change the leaders. Yeah. I think, you know, they need to address head on these skepticisms about their role in the region and their support for terrorism and things like that.
But the Trump administration is also not just unpopular at home and abroad. It's also, there's never been this kind of mixing of statecraft and private business. And Jared Kushner apparently shook down the Guttery Royals for $500 million for his building at 666 Fifth Avenue that's underwater. And that they told him to go to hell. And then shortly thereafter, the Saudis blockaded Qatar in another boneheaded move similar to the bombing of Yemen, where there's no end game. Now we see that Jared, apparently the rumors are that he's been made whole by the Saudis, maybe even with some of the confiscated wealth from all the princes that were arrested by MBS. But it's a pretty sordid situation. And there are also rumors that Donald Trump, the Saudis have guaranteed him money for his re-election. So what's your sense about what's going on here with this particular government that mixes government with business in no way than any prior administration in the history of this country has done?
Yeah, I don't know about some of the things you said there. I just don't know the veracity of it. I know in a place like Saudi Arabia, where it's pretty opaque and authoritarian, there is sort of ample room for rumors and conspiracies and things like this. But the one thing I would say is that when I look at the Trump administration, and I wrote an article about this last year, the Trump administration has moved to a model of and style of governing that I've been accustomed to from my 2 decades or 25 years of traveling and working across the Middle East. In many ways, Trump actually looks like a Middle East dictator or a monarch. He's installed key members of his family in government and appointed them to official positions. Saddam Hussein did this with his sons. Hafez al-Assad, of course, we know his son is now president of Syria. So that's one. Second, Trump has blurred the lines of authority for these family members, so it's confusing for people who are serving in government with Jared Kushner and Ivanka because, you know, they sense that they're the real power. Three, he's kept their family business going, right? Trump has kept his own family business. This has been done by Middle East monarchs and dictators. He's filled his government with generals. That's another aspect. Trump has hated on the media. If you remember Baghdad Bob, when Saddam Hussein's information minister during the 2003 Iraq War, he was denying that there were any troops in the U.S. troops in the country and things like this. And this is similar to the Trump administration's notion of alternative facts. So all of this is all quite murky. What's different about this, it's not much different in the Middle East, sadly. What's different is that we have a U.S. administration, which has become very much like a Middle East dictatorship. And that's the thing I think should concern most Americans, is that where are the checks and balances on all of the mixed business interests, the militarization of foreign policy by the Trump administration, all of this, I think puts us on a very shaky territory here.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Brian Katulis, what do you think is going to be announced? Usually these visits, the visit of MBS to London ended with a purchase, I think, for 48 fighter jets by Saudi Arabia. So there's a rumor that Trump's going to announce the sale of dual-use nuclear reactors to the Saudis. As you know, in the 60 Minutes interview, MBS suggested that if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, Saudi Arabia would immediately do the same. That, of course, would be a step in that direction, having nuclear reactors, which Saudis, obviously, they're very oil-rich, so it's a little dubious as to why they'd want them in the first place.
Yeah, well, any sort of announcement like that would require the consent of Congress, and I think there already is a very big debate about it. If you saw the news and when Israel's prime minister was here a couple of weeks ago, he spoke privately to Congress and came out strongly opposed to any notion of such an agreement. The experts I talked to on a what they call a 1-2-3 agreement, which would essentially be one that helps Saudi Arabia produce domestic enrichment or domestic energy, but that's closely monitored. And we have a similar agreement with the United Arab Emirates that all of these facilities actually have very tight monitoring, much higher standards than we have in the Iran nuclear deal, which I think is a good thing. I'm mixed on whether or not an agreement with Saudi Arabia on this front would be a good thing. And I don't know that this will be a big feature of the visit. What I suspect we'll end up hearing is, again, more rhetoric about Iran and its role in the region. I know that there's going to be a trilateral set of meetings between the United States, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates to talk about Iran and address ways to counter its destabilizing influence. But I think the biggest feature will be, and most of the time the Crown Prince is going to be spending in the United States is not in Washington. It'll be business deals. He's going to New York, Boston, I believe Seattle, and out on the West Coast in California. And a big part of this agenda, I think, is to move the U.S.-Saudi bilateral relationship from this narrow sliver of massive arms sales and military cooperation and energy and oil cooperation to other sectors, to the tech sectors, to education and things like this. And as I said, on my trips to Saudi Arabia, if you move beyond the leadership and talk to the ordinary Saudi citizen, they want this. They want sort of a new type of economy, and they want these connections to our country. And I think that's a good thing. But the thing we need to safeguard against is the role that Saudi's playing and Saudi Arabia's playing in the region. We need to do more than I think Trump has been willing to do to exercise our leverage against them. So my hope that is that this visit actually produces some positive things on those other other aspects of the relationship. That too often the Saudi Arabia debate is focused on the negatives, and there are a lot of negatives. But in some ways, if that society really is changing, we need to be actually open-minded and not polemical about sort of and cynical about the possibilities of change there.
Well, Brian Katulis, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Yeah, great to be with you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Brian Katulis, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who focuses on U.S. national security policy in the Middle East and South Asia. He has served on projects in more than two dozen countries, including Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Egypt, and lived and worked in the West Bank and Gaza Strip and Egypt, and was a Fulbright scholar in Amman, Jordan, where he conducted research on the peace treaty between Israel and Jordan. An Arabic speaker, he's the co-author of The Prosperity Agenda. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the war the Saudi Crown Prince is waging against Yemen and the vote today in the Senate to kill a bipartisan resolution to end U.S. complicity in the bombing and starving of Yemeni women and children. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Shireen Aladimi, who is a graduate student at Harvard University, where she's currently completing her doctorate in education. Originally from Yemen, she has been working to bring attention to the U.S.'s role in the ongoing war on Yemen and has a recent article at Common Dreams, Only Americans Can Stop America's War on Yemen. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shireen Aladimi.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us, Shireen. And in terms of Americans stopping America's war on Yemen, it looks as if the Senate today failed to do that. Obviously, there was pressure from the Pentagon, from General Mattis. And, of course, the vote coincides with the arrival of Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, at the White House. So had it passed, of course, it would have been a pretty strong rebuke to the Crown Prince, who started this war in 2015, and it doesn't seem like he has particularly thought it through. So is there an end game from the Saudi Arabian point of view?
The end game for the Saudis, there doesn't seem to be one. Mohammed bin Salman has waged this war starting in 2015, and I think he did this, you know, in a very brash manner, hoping that this could be an issue that is curtailed within a couple of months. Of course, that hasn't panned out. It's been 3 years, so far he hasn't gained significant control in Yemen and has only caused the world's largest humanitarian crisis. And so, you know, there's no way for him to save face at this point. He continues to wage war with the help, significant help from the United States. There doesn't seem to be an end in sight. And like you said, the Senate just voted to kill the resolution that would have extricated U.S. role involvement in Yemen. So that's also something that will continue to embolden him.
But the resolution under the War Powers Act was brought to the floor by Senator Bernie Sanders and Senator Mike Lee, Republican of Utah. So it had bipartisan support. And apparently, President Trump is supposed to have brought up the issue of the humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen with the Crown Prince. Do we have any guarantees that that's the case? Because my understanding is that both Trump and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, have financial ties with the Saudi Arabians, and particularly with the young Crown Prince. And it's often when the Trumps are involved in the family, it's hard to dissociate, you know, diplomacy from business.
Right. The bottom line is whether it's the Obama administration or the Trump administration, you know, personally and otherwise, have benefited financially from the relationship with the Saudis. The Saudis, we've sold billions in weapons to the Saudis, but the military contracts that the U.S. has with the Saudi National Guard have also, you know, amounted to millions per month, $129 million per month. And so there's no incentive on the U.S.'s side to end their support of the Saudis. And, of course, the Saudis keep promising that they didn't mean to bomb hospitals, they didn't mean to bomb schools, or that, you know, it's all fake news and they're actually trying to liberate Yemen from Yemenis, apparently. You know, the Saudis are getting away with committing war crimes, and we continue to support them.
So exactly what are the U.S. supplying in terms of military aid to Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen?
So the United States provides mid-air refueling to Saudi jets as they're bombing mostly civilian targets. They train Saudi soldiers. They advise their military personnel. They maintain, repair, and upgrade vehicles and aircraft. You know, this is an addition, of course, to the billions in weapon sales. And so there's significant support there. They, you know, they help with navigation and communication and so on. And so the Saudi-led coalition is heavily dependent on the U.S.'s involvement there.
Well, of course, President Trump took a dig at the Obama administration in greeting the Saudi Crown Prince at the White House, saying, I would really have to say this: the relationship was, to put it mildly, very, very strained during the Obama administration, and the relationship now is probably as good as it really has ever been. The fact of the matter is that the Obama administration didn't in any way stop the humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen, did they? Did they have a peace plan? I don't recognize a peace plan on the part of the Trump administration, but had the Obama administration tried to rein in Saudi Arabia?
Not at all. The Obama administration got involved with the Saudis, starting with their, you know, March 26 attack on Yemen, and have not backed out since then. And so I think what Trump is referring to maybe is the fact that the Obama administration passed the Iran nuclear deal despite protests from Saudi Arabia. But in Yemen, they've been partners, and the Obama administration has helped the Saudis as much as Trump organization is helping the Saudis.
But let's turn to Yemen itself in terms of factionalism, tribalism, and fratricide. It's very hard to follow. Originally, the leader, Hadi, was driven out. He went to Saudi Arabia. Then the warlord, Saleh, seemed to have made some kind of deal with the Houthis. But then recently, I think he turned on the Houthis, and recently they killed him. How much are the warring factions in Yemen itself responsible for this catastrophe?
Of course, you know, tensions have been brewing in Yemen since the 2011 Arab Spring. And so Yemenis, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of Yemenis went to the streets to protest Ali Abdullah Saleh's 33-year rule. And things went south when his former allies joined the opposition. And he eventually stepped down that year, and Hadi was placed as his interim president, and it was supposed to be a two-year term. He was supposed to redraft the constitution and create a unity government and whatnot. He failed to do so. And the Houthis applied pressure on him by taking over Sana'a with the help of Saleh. But, you know, Hadi's two-year term had expired, and then he resigned after that, and then he fled to Aden and began asking the Saudis to bomb Yemen to help him, to help reinstate him. And so, of course, there's a lot going on internally, and this civil war essentially turned into foreign intervention when the Saudis began bombing Yemen. And, you know, with the help of most of the Gulf countries, many Arab countries, and U.S., U.K., and France, and so on. So it's no longer, I think, can be considered a civil war, given the extent of the foreign intervention. But even if the intervention were to stop today, we'll still have problems. There's still going to be issues there where people have to, but, you know, the issue here is that Yemenis have to sort these issues out for themselves, and it's really difficult to do that when there's so much foreign intervention.
So what about the notion that this war in Yemen is a proxy war, or at least some of the players, particularly the Saudis, believe it is? They believe that Iran is backing the Houthis. There's no question that Iran is backing the Assad regime in Syria, and arguably no Iranians are dying, but lots of Syrians are dying, and equally true, no Saudis are dying, or few are, or Emiratis, who are also fighting with the Saudis, but an awful lot of Yemenis are dying, including children who are being starved to death because of this blockade. So what's your response to the notion that Yemen is a victim of a proxy war between the Saudi regime and the Iranian regime?
I mean, this is one of the many lies that the Saudis have crafted in order to justify their presence in Yemen. They've cast this conflict as a sectarian conflict. It's absolutely not a sectarian conflict. It's not a Sunni Shia conflict. And while Iran is involved in Syria, it by no means is involved in Yemen, at least not to the same degree. They're not supplying the Houthis with weapons. They're not providing any sort of assistance to the Houthis. The fact of the matter is that Saudi Arabia, the Emiratis, you know, up until recently, Qatar, Bahrain, Morocco, Jordan, Egypt, all these countries are involved in this war directly. And they're casting it as a sectarian war in order to justify their presence in Yemen. Otherwise, why are they involved in such a, you know, massive humanitarian disaster? There's no other way to justify it other than to say, well, we're trying to curtail Iranian influence in Yemen. This is by no means an Iranian war in Yemen or a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. For us Yemenis, this is, you know, today's the 15th anniversary of the Iraq War, and I remember the WMD story that 9/11 was connected to the Iraqis, and that, you know, the Iraqis had WMDs, and this feels like one more instance of a lie that has been told so many times that people hold it to be true, but there's very little evidence to support that.
But why at least Saudi Arabia, and whether or not Iran is involved is another matter, but why Saudi Arabia and the Emiratis? What do they want out of the poorest country in the Middle East that already has terrible problems in terms of insufficient water and food supplies? So is there any strategic gain for what the Saudis are doing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So Yemen controls Bab el-Mandeb Strait, where 3.8 million barrels of oil travel through every single day. And, of course, this is a lot of it is Saudi oil, so they want to protect their interests there. But if you also look at the Arabian Peninsula, you have Saudi Arabia, and which is a kingdom, and then other countries that are kingdoms or emirates or sultanates. And Yemen is a republic. Yemen has had, spirit of democracy for, whether that's worked or not for Yemenis is a different issue. But the Saudis have always tried to enforce their views in Yemen. And this happened in the 60s when the Yemenis were fighting for independence and the Saudis partnered up with the British to try to quash that. It happened in 1994, a war that I lived through when the Saudis were involved. Also, they've taken sides in the Yemeni civil war and were arming one side against the other. And so it's not new for the Saudis to be involved in Yemeni politics, but this is an instance this is the most involved they've been in Yemeni politics.
But in terms, when you say that there was no Iranian involvement, the Saudis are making a big deal out of a missile, a Scud missile that landed at the Riyadh airport, and they're claiming that that was an Iranian-manufactured missile. So, I mean, there are a couple of two questions. One is, I'm not sure how, if indeed Iran is supplying the Houthis, how anything gets past the blockade, because the blockade is so it's airtight that the children in Yemen are starving. So the blockade appears to be working. But nevertheless, how, if the Saudi claim is true that that was an Iranian Scud missile that hit the airport at Riyadh, how did the Houthis get hold of it?
So it's not an Iranian missile. The Ali Abdullah Saleh, the previous president, had stockpiled for 30 years, had stockpiled missiles in Yemen. And the Houthis are simply using those. They're modifying some of these. And, 2 days after Nikki Haley had that demonstration where she said that this missile came from Iran or is Iranian manufactured, there was a secret UN report that leaked, and they had done an investigation, and they said that, no, actually, this came from Yemen, and it doesn't have any Iranian footprints on it. And so, again, this is part of the story that the Saudis are trying to really paint in order to justify this war. The Yemenis are using whatever they can, whatever missiles are left, to try to counterattack the Saudis, and it's very minimal. The Saudis intercept most of the missiles, if not all of them, that go into Saudi Arabia. And like you said, there's a land, air, and sea blockade where people, I have family there that's trapped. People can't leave. Food can't come in. People are starving. Every single day, 130 children at least are dying because they're starving, and we're led to believe that somehow Iran is bringing in these missiles to Yemen.
Well, the humanitarian case was made on the Senate floor today by Bernie Sanders and other senators. Is that to say it's falling on deaf ears? 60 Minutes did a recent piece showing these skeletally thin young kids dying of malnutrition. It was really heart-wrenching footage. So your piece in Common Dreams is titled Only Americans Can Stop America's War on Yemen. Well, number one, Americans don't even recognize or realize that there is an American war on Yemen in complicity with the Saudi Arabians. But what was your sense from the debates today on the Senate floor that some compassion is going to be shown here on a humanitarian level?
I think several senators spoke very passionately about our role in creating this world's largest humanitarian crisis. They've shown pictures of starving children, like you said, and the bill that was just failed to pass. It was pretty close. I think 45 senators voted to pass it, and so there's hope there that there's raising, increasing awareness. But like you said, the average American doesn't even know, anything about Yemen, or that, let alone that we're involved in that war, and we've helped cause this humanitarian crisis. The 60 Minutes piece that aired a couple months ago failed to mention that the U.S. had any role in helping the Saudis create this humanitarian crisis. And the 60 Minutes episode that aired the other day, interviewing Mohammed bin Salman, who's in the U.S. today, failed to really push him on his role in creating the crisis, and allowed him to get away with saying that the Houthis, in fact, are the ones who are blockading the humanitarian aid, despite, reports from the UN and all sorts of humanitarian organizations that have said that the Saudis are, in fact, the ones who are blockading Yemen, and they're the ones who are preventing aid and food from coming into the country. And so I'm not sure, where to go from here. This was a good effort by Senator Sanders and Lee and Murphy to try to bring an end to U.S. involvement, but it's one more disappointment. It's, you know, 3 years of just a war that has gone without congressional approval and continues to wreak havoc on millions of lives.
So just in closing, is there a solution here? The U.N. has been issuing warnings about this humanitarian catastrophe. You've just pointed out it's the worst in the world, and that's really saying something, given some of the misery and suffering going on with the Rohingyas and others in Burma. Do you think there was a deal done in the Senate, you know, that we go along with the Pentagon, because the Pentagon argument was basically, you know, we can't afford to upset the Saudis at this moment, and particularly when the Crown Prince is there at the White House. But do you think they got anything out of it? You know, okay, we'll vote not to embarrass MBS, but you got to do something about the humanitarian situation. Is that wishful thinking, or do you think something went on behind the scenes?
I think that's wishful thinking, to be honest. I'm not sure they really care about the humanitarian crisis. Many of these people are the same people who led us to war several times. And humanitarian crisis has been going on for 3 years. It's just been, you know, getting from bad to worse. We have 80% of the population now who's in need of humanitarian aid. That's, you know, 25 million people. And so I don't think humanitarian crisis is what's going to get us out of the war. I think there has to be an articulation, maybe a more cogent articulation, that this war is really hindering U.S. interests in the area. So we claim to want to fight terror, but this war has actually enabled terrorists like ISIS and al-Qaeda. We're working with the Saudis, who have no problem working with al-Qaeda, and it's been documented in Yemen that they've worked alongside al-Qaeda in this war. I don't think, you know, starving children stopped people from passing or stopping a war, because at the end of the day, they're making so much money out of this, and the relationship with Saudi Arabia is first and foremost the most important thing.
Well, Shireen Al-Adeimi, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Shireen Al-Adeimi, who's a graduate student at Harvard University, where she's currently completing her doctorate in education. Originally from Yemen, she has been working to bring attention to the U.S.'s role in the ongoing war in Yemen, and has a recent article at Common Dreams, Only Americans Can Stop America's War on Yemen. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back and go to the U.K. to discuss the angry reaction in the British Parliament against Cambridge Analytica and Facebook. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from the UK is Mike Harris, who's the CEO of 89UP and the publisher of Little Atoms. He writes on human rights, surveillance, and free speech. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Harris.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks. And there's been quite a lot of coverage in the British media about Cambridge Analytica, and in particular, it's the head of the company, Alexander Nix, I believe. Well, I've certainly seen coverage in The Guardian and The Observer, but Channel 4 have been running a series of documentaries, including some undercover footage that they have of Alexander Nix really saying some outrageous things. This has led the Parliamentary Committee on Digital Culture, Media and Sports to basically say that they were deliberately misled by him. Now the UK Parliament is talking about, at least parliamentarians are talking about, having Zuckerberg, the head of Facebook, testify. But I just understand it's just happened that Alexander Nix has been fired by his own company. So is that your understanding?
He's been suspended.
Suspended, yeah. Right. So obviously we haven't seen the Channel 4 sting footage yet, but it's pretty provocative. Just tell us what the mood is in the UK, because we've been pretty slow in this country, certainly behind the Europeans, in recognizing the enormous monopoly power of Facebook, Google, Amazon, Apple, and Microsoft, and this whole notion of surveillance capitalism, which is this new business model that certainly Facebook and Google operate on. So what's the sense in the UK? You think this is going to lead to some really more transparency from these big monopolies?
Well, I mean, London is the biggest city market for Facebook in the world in terms of the amount of advertising they sell here. And it's the same for Google's platforms. So actually, the UK is a very valuable market for these big tech giants. But they have been treating UK politicians essentially... they've basically been pulling the wool over the eyes of UK politicians. They've been quite dismissive when it's come to parliamentary inquiries. There's now a lot of anger in Westminster, the way they've been treated by these tech firms, who essentially think that they've got to be worried about US Congress, they've got to be worried about Brussels, but basically London will go along with whatever Facebook and Google do. To a certain extent, that's been true and right. Obviously, the UK is in a vulnerable position with Brexit. But there's a lot of anger at Westminster. Damien Collins feels that not just Alexander Nix misled him in testimony to his committee, but Damien Collins, who is the chair of the Culture, Media, Sports Select Committee, feels that Facebook and the internet giants have misled him or haven't given him 100% transparency about the way that their platforms have been used by Cambridge Analytica and also by other third parties such as the Russian government. So there's a sort of level of anger that's starting to seep up. And on top of that, a bigger problem for Facebook and Google is the British media is very boisterous and the tabloid press hate Facebook and they hate Google and they hate them because they're taking their advertising revenues away. And so there's a real backlash about these technology companies. And they're feeling it from sort of two sides. One, commercially, they're very dominant. But also, the sort of British attitudes towards privacy are somewhere in between those of continental Europe and perhaps the US, where free speech is seen as more important. Britain's sort of in the middle. And so our attitude towards privacy is actually people do have a sort of certain sense that these internet companies shouldn't be harvesting our private data, shouldn't be using these dark ads with super target dark ads during political campaigns aren't necessarily that okay. And there is a general unease about the direction of travel. So all of this is pushing towards potentially Facebook, Google and Twitter having a really difficult few months here, especially with the Information Commissioner's investigation, which is basically starting to happen.
You mentioned Brexit, Mike. There is, of course, a connection with Cambridge Analytica and Brexit. It's almost as though Stephen Bannon and Mercer, the bankroller of Cambridge Analytica, who was the biggest donor to Donald Trump's campaign, and, of course, Stephen Bannon ran his campaign after Manafort was fired. The assumption is that Facebook was used also in promoting Brexit as a kind of dress rehearsal for how much Facebook was used, or the 50 million users were unwittingly used by the Trump campaign via Cambridge Analytica. And there's a feeling over here that Facebook may well have helped elect Donald Trump, if not holding them directly responsible for the election. As you probably know, there's a lot of anger in this country. More Americans voted against Trump than voted for him, and his poll numbers are at an all-time low or continue to be very low. So, I mean, I think that Facebook is getting some residual anger in this country because so many people in this country hate Trump. Is that happening with Brexit?
And they are behaving.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and Facebook are behaving like they have no questions to answer. You know, Facebook Response to the Observer story was to threaten to sue a national newspaper. It was threatened to sue a liberal newspaper. So they put forward, you know, reporting which was clearly in the public interest, and they got, you know, they got threatened by Facebook. Facebook have closed down the account, the Facebook account of Christopher Wiley, the whistleblower. They are going in heavy-handed, and they are saying, you mess with us on our platform, we're coming to get you. And that is absolutely outrageous. And I think that Facebook are starting to, they're really starting to exert their power. And I don't think, I think that these tech giants are going from being things that we like, companies we associate ourselves with. There's starting to be a bit of a dark side to them. And I'm not sure I don't think that we're firstly aware of how much personal information they store about us, but also if they do so, these are companies with enormous cash reserves, if they start really lashing out and really pushing back against investigative journalists, against politicians, this could get really messy really soon. The other thing is, obviously, in both the UK and the US, it's become very polarised. So there is a sense in the UK that the Leave campaign cheated, and that's how they won the referendum on Britain leaving the European Union. There's also a sense, I sense in the US, that Trump and Cambridge Analytica cheated. And while Hillary won the popular vote, Trump won the 80,000 extra votes that he needed in order to get a majority in the Electoral College. And that feels, there's something about that. Once you add in the very, very highly targeted advertising, once you add in the fact that it is alleged that Cambridge Analytica had 50 million profiles, personal messages, personal preferences, once you add that together, there is a general feeling that, you know, was that election fair? You know, very small things like these adverts, these run by Cambridge Analytica, the hacking of, you know, the hacking, potential hacking by the Russians, Russian disinformation campaigns by Russia Today and Sputnik, the Russian TV channels. All of these things may have contributed a tiny bit, but that might have been enough to swing the Electoral College. So it doesn't take very much to actually put a picture that maybe this does need to be investigated to a much greater extent than is happening at the moment.
Well, the digital head of Trump's campaign, Brad Parcell, of course, has been named by Trump to head up his 2020 re-election campaign. He was on a very popular current affairs program here in the U.S. 60 Minutes a month or so ago, where he said quite openly that Donald Trump won because they used Facebook. So that's pretty much from the horse's mouth.
Yeah. I have worked on a campaign where we ran Facebook ads, targeted ads, to during the general election in 2017. And we used targeted ads in order to basically put forward a tactical vote campaign. But the difference is, right, there is a difference between advertising, where there is a transparent organization pushing a certain political message, where the targeting is done in broad demographics, so we want to reach people in Manchester or Liverpool, and we want to reach people who may be interested in this, okay? Facebook's great for that, okay? And that no one would say there's something underhand about that, as long as that expenditure is transparently declared. The difference is, this Cambridge Analytica story is about Cambridge Analytica getting access to 50 million accounts and having wholesale access to those people's likes, their statuses, and things like that. If this allegation is true, the Trump campaign had an enormous advantage over the Clinton campaign, like a fundamental advantage. And that really is the crux of this. If that is proven to be true, and Cambridge Analytica denied it, Facebook denied they had access, but if that is proven to be true, then I think you say they had a game-changing advantage over the Clinton campaign. And you know, that is enough to swing an election. And we still don't know what Cambridge Analytica denied that they worked on the Leave campaign, but and are threatening to sue anyone that suggests otherwise. But There are other tweets and other posts that suggest that they were involved.
Weren't there meetings also with WikiLeaks? Or am I getting that wrong?
Yes, it's suggested that, again, this is an allegation. Julian Assange said no, there were no links between Cambridge Analytica and WikiLeaks, but it is suggested that there was a line of communication between Cambridge Analytica and WikiLeaks. And, of course, WikiLeaks had the had access to the Clinton stash of emails, and Julian Assange was one of the most sort of outspoken critics of Hillary Clinton. And Julian Assange, of course, has you know, linked to the Russian government. So it's all a mess. And I think in the US, because you do have that. You know, because Congress does have those additional powers to bring witnesses in front of it, I feel that, you know, those investigations are probably going to yield quite a lot. I think that Mark Zuckerberg is going to refuse to come to Parliament in the UK. And I think that Facebook has behaved very high-handed to date. And I think that's going to lose Facebook a lot of fans in the UK.
Well, but these tech giants, Facebook and in particular Google, do spread their money around on Capitol Hill. And we have a problem in our government because we have essentially the wrecking crew in the White House. But they're enabled by the Republicans, which is a separate branch, the legislative branch, that's supposed to be a check and balance on the executive branch. And they're not exercising that influence and that power. They are essentially enablers for Trump, although some of them now are talking up about warning Trump not to fire the special prosecutor. But, you know, again, today Trump talked about a very nice call he had with Vladimir Putin congratulating him on winning the election. Nobody, as far as I know, in the rest of the world, I can't imagine Theresa May is calling up congratulating Putin after he used a weapon of mass destruction on British soil against an exiled Russian spy.
No, and I think this is where it gets very worrying for the UK because, and this is kind of totally off topic, but the, no one in Russia credibly believes that America is Russia's enemy anymore. People in Russia believe that Putin put Trump in the White House. So they're like, so the Russian public are no longer kind of frightened by American belligerence or really by NATO. And so what Putin has had to do is create artificial manufactured crises. So, for example, using chemical weapons on British soil for the first time, that chemical weapons have been used on European soil since the First World War, in order to create a new enemy. And that new enemy is the UK. And so tensions between the UK and Russia are at an all-time high. And actually, with some additional sanctions, it looks like the British government is going to release next week. It's possible that those sanctions ratchet further. So the UK is now Putin's number one enemy. And, you know, Putin is not frightened of Germany because he has so many willing... he's got, you know, the Social Democrats in Germany are very, very much aligned with Putin, unfortunately. The only other country he's frightened of in Europe is France, but Macron has been making overtures. But actually, Britain finds itself isolated, and it's a very, very difficult situation because simultaneously there is a sort of, there's an underlying concern that the Russians may have had quite a lot of influence in the European referendum, but also the Prime Minister, who is now pushing Britain out of the European Union, finds herself with the Russians increasingly saber-rattling. So it's quite an uncertain situation.
Well, that's one of the extraordinary things, that Russia helped the Brexit vote. They helped Trump. It's as though everything is Putin is succeeding enormously. And, of course, it's a great irony, as you just pointed out, that the Russian people, because they figure that Putin put Trump in the White House, that they've got nothing to worry about with the Americans since they own the White House. And now they're beating up on the Brits in order for, of course, it did help. And that was basically the election theme, that Putin wasn't worried about losing the elections. He just wanted to get enough people out to make it appear to be a legitimate exercise. So just in the last minute, though, I'd like to turn back to, we, of course, are not seeing the Channel 4 investigative piece on Alexander Nixon and the sting that they did against him, the CEO of Cambridge Analytica. Describe what some of this footage is like. It sounds pretty extraordinary, where you've got this sort of Etonian businessman talking like a kind of street gangster offering up Ukrainian hookers to entrap opposition politicians.
I mean, and you know, the use of hookers is extraordinary because, of course, that is a classic Russian tactic to basically, you know, so in a strange sense, Nix is just taking something straight out of the old book, you know, the sort of disinformation book from the Soviet era. But the boasts are incredible. Alexander Nix boasts about the full scale of Cambridge Analytica's pivotal role in Trump's election win. They talk about how they avoid congressional investigations into their foreign clients. They talk about setting up proxy organizations to feed untraceable messages onto social media, using a secret email system where messages self-destruct. Their involvement in the Defeat Crooked Hillary branded ads that were run on Facebook. And the Channel 4 presenter posed as a wealthy client, hoping to get their candidates elected in Sri Lanka. And, of course, Sri Lanka is a country where there's been a lot of, there's been a civil war until recently. Politics is very often very, very murky. And so Cambridge Analytica were desperate for the business, making all these boasts to people who they didn't even bother checking, you know, they didn't even check the bonus Fridays of these supposed this supposed political party. So, you know, there's a number of boasts. They're quite extraordinary. They're all sort of, you know, the dark arts, the worst things you'd think could possibly happen in an election trail. So, yeah, it's pretty extraordinary. I think you may be able to access it on channel4.com. And also clips of it are available on Channel 4 News' Twitter feeds. You can see some of it for yourself, but the footage is really quite shocking.
Well, Mark Harris, I thank you very much for joining us here.
Thanks very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Harris, who's in the United Kingdom. He's the CEO of 89 Up and the publisher of Little Atoms, and he writes on human rights, surveillance, and free speech. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.